Everything is better on a boat, and your vacation is no exception. This year, experience the world's most beautiful destinations aboard your own private yacht charter with The Moorings. Our fleet of modern, custom-designed yachts is just one reason we were recently voted Best Caribbean Yacht Charter Company by readers of Caribbean Journal. So when you next explore the Virgin Islands, the Bahamas, or elsewhere, don't accept anything less than The Moorings. Your vacation time is precious, so make the most of your freedom on the water. Book your perfect charter at moorings.com. Nothing less than The Moorings.
At Tanger Outlets, find hundreds of brands at unbeatable value. Save big on outerwear, must-have handbags, active essentials, classic favorites, footwear, and more, up to 70% off. Shop Nike Factory Store, Coach, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. All the best brands, all on sale, every day. Only at Tanger Outlets.
Welcome to Sawcast number 53. My name is John Strykemeyer. Today I will be your host for this show. And as always, we thank Jocko Willink Productions to make this happen. And this is a unique episode in that today we are in Las Vegas for the Special Operations Association 48th reunion. Again, this is possible through Jocko Willink Productions. And today, I'd like to welcome Gary Green, a Covey pilot that served during the Vietnam War and the Secret War. And Gary, welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you.
Indeed. And so talk to us a little bit about what made you interested in flying. How'd you get into the Army or Air Force as a Covey pilot?
Well, the draft was right on my heels all the way through college.
Indeed.
And I went into the Air Force as soon as I could and went to pilot training, went to OTS and then pilot training. And the vast majority of my class went to Vietnam.
And what was your time frame on that, Gary?
Got out of pilot training in May of 69, class 6907 was our class, and we graduated in May, I believe it was. At the time, you went through survival school and checking out an EO2 and all. It was September of 69.
What was survival school like? We never hear about this Air Force survival school.
Well, we had to go to Global Survival out at Fairchild. And your SEER training were simulated POW.
Sure. And how long was that?
Well, I would say that was probably about a 10-day, maybe 2-week course.
Did it leave a deep impression on you?
It did. The POW interrogation was very interesting, where they treated like a POW.
Sure.
And I had a pair of guys that were interviewing me. And the strange thing about that, about 6 or 8 months later, they called us up at Plate Coup, and they'd caught a prisoner up around Kontum. And he'd come down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and Gary Old and I went up there to interview him. And lo and behold, the same two guys that were doing my interview in training were the ones interviewing this kid.
No.
And it was a very interesting experience. It's about a 17-year-old kid from the Haiphong area that had come down the trail. And he wasn't reluctant to talk to us. He told us what he knew about where the truck parks were, but he never knew where he was, and didn't get much useful information out of him. But the thing I remember was that his attitude was so good. He was absolutely convinced that they were winning the war. And I remember riding back down the hill from the MACV compound where they were holding the prisoners and asked Gary Onison, "You think we're supporting the wrong side here?"
Yeah.
Boy, that guy's got such confidence in Jap and the leaders of the North Vietnam that he said, we're way ahead of our schedule. We're winning the war. Don't you guys realize that? And I'm still stupid enough to think we were winning the war here. And I've thought about that a lot over the years.
Sure. And what was your time frame on that interview then? Would it be like at the end of 69 or early 70 if you've been in country for a little while?
Gary Owen and I were senior facts at that time, both first lieutenants.
So you had to spend some time flying before you get that?
Probably in the springtime.
Okay. Of 1970.
Probably in the spring of 70. I think it must have been late spring. We went into Cambodia, and April, maybe the 1st of May of 70. And must have been, and then
for the incursion.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. See, Nixon came into power in early in January of 69.
Yes, sir.
And so he had a plan to get us out of there and to go through Vietnamization of the war. And before we invaded Cambodia, we were getting hammered every night with 122 millimeter rockets, and SAPR attacks. And after we invaded Cambodia, I don't think we ever had a gunshot fired around Pleiku.
So, and where were you based then? Out of Pleiku?
Pleiku.
Okay.
Entire time in Pleiku. I never flew a combat sortie in Vietnam. 100% of my time was in Laos or Cambodia.
No kidding.
733 hours of combat time in Laos and Cambodia.
Yeah, sure. Wow, okay. So, was there, as you go through that progression of time, you're the new guy on the, in the, as a covey?
Got there, our primary mission was hunting truck convoys at night with the O2.
Right.
We had black O2s, and they had four wing stations on them, where the in-country facts were gray, and just had two hard points on the wings.
Those were for fuel, extra fuel?
No, we carried a B-37K rack on the right inboard station that would carry four log markers. We had a pod of seven Willie Peets on the right outboard.
Okay.
And then we would carry, as I recall, just individual log markers on the two on the left wing. Because the Willie Peets were pretty much useless for marking trucks at night. You use those magnesium log markers that would burn very bright on the ground.
Right.
We never use flares. I tried to work under flares dropped by A7s a couple times. That just illuminates you, and they'd hose you.
So you're talking about some things here that's common knowledge for you, but for our listeners, first of all, you get in country, you get assigned to be a covey. Was that a surprise, or had you trained previously on the O2 before coming into country?
No, we trained on the O2 at Herbert Field during the summer. Checked out in the O2, and I assumed I'd got to be a forward air controller assigned to some army unit.
So you knew
that? In Vietnam.
Right, okay.
And they sent Roger Hayward and I to Da Nang and said, well, don't unpack your bags. You guys are going to play coup. Okay.
Welcome to the secret war, baby.
Yeah. And okay, well, they do there. Well,
we can't talk about it.
You'll be flying out country. I didn't even know what that meant. I didn't know what. And they said, well, you'll be flying across the fence. Hayward and I looked at each other and thinking, what are we getting ourselves into here? And then found out we fly at night. And to me, night flying was an emergency procedure. I didn't like that at all.
But, sure.
It was very interesting once you got your feet wet and learned how to do it.
And then for those of us, particularly other than you and I talking a couple of days ago, I never heard about O2s or our coveys. And that's for our viewers. A covey is the code name in SOG for our facts, for
the
air control.
That was the call sign,
yes, sir,
of of all the 20th TAS facts that worked out country, the 20th TAS had in-country facts with different call signs, but the boys at Da Nang were 200 level coveys. Mm-hmm. Their call signs were all 220, 255, some of that nature. The Pleiku coveys were 5-level coveys. I was covey 533.
Okay.
So if you call, heard
was there
a covey
anything
call,
significant in those numbers?
You just knew whether it was a Da Nang based covey. If it was a 2-level covey,
right,
or if it was a 5-level covey, you knew it was out of Pleiku.
Sure.
And we had different sectors in Laos that we worked. The coveys out of Pleiku worked VR7, which went far north, about as far north, well, where we put the tailwind team in, it was as far north as I'd ever been. We just,
right,
that was so far, we just never went up that far.
It's
almost,
yeah,
a,
they
almost to Chavain.
Yeah.
And then from Chavain north, that was Da Nang Covey.
Right, okay, yeah.
But we started out hunting trucks at night.
And what was that like? I mean, how they break you in as a new covey pilot, say, hey, have you guys flown much? If not, we're going to do some night missions for good luck. I mean, that could be quite a wake-up call.
Well, you start out on a daytime sortie with an experienced FAC and learn the routes. Flying in daytime and see where the road structure is.
So what was that like flying over the Ho Chi Minh Trail?
In the daytime, there was nothing going on out there. The trucks don't run it in the daytime.
Right.
And we were up there trying to stay around 4,500 AGL, above ground level, where you give enough slant range, you're not going to get hit, probably. And then you keep the airplane moving. You don't fly straight level.
Right.
You're wandering around, changing your heading constantly. But surveying the route structure, learn where the interdiction points were, where the major landmarks were. You'd see burned out trucks where they'd killed them the night before.
Sure.
But.
And you were able to make those personal observations just from flying the trail in the daytime.
Yeah.
Well, no kidding.
The trail was bombed out where the road, for the most part, was very visible. You had IDPs down there like.
What's an IDP? Excuse me.
Interdiction point.
Okay.
Where they thought to get a road cut.
Sure.
Where there was the White Cliffs, there was the Red Cliffs, there was the Dog's Head where we had a couple fords. We had the Bra where there was fords across that. You had the Falls. You had 6019, which was just the coordinates. Yankee Bravo 6019 was a.
Is that a point where some trails came together that you tried to cut them
it
off?
It was where the trail went across. There was a stream and a steep hill, and the road went up around that hill. That's where they put ashtray first, ashtray one, and then ashtray two. Put a hatchet force in there with mortars and RPGs.
Oh, and, for a slam operation.
Slam operation to close the trail.
Wow.
And they ended up being so much bombing that that peak was just like as bare as an ice cream cone sticking up out there. There's a little bit of foliage right on the top of it where the team had been. The rest of it was wiped clean.
Okay.
But you learn the trail, and then we had navigators. Most of our navigators were majors and lieutenant colonels. A lot of them came out of the B-57 program, the Yellowbirds down at
they were further south?
The Yellowbirds were B-57s that had closed that squadron. And the guys that didn't have their year time in, they sent them to fly with us as navigators with the window open and the right seat with hanging a starlight scope out there.
Really?
See the trucks. And 30 minutes after sunset, when it got dark, here you see the trucks come out of the truck parks and start motoring down the trail.
No kidding.
Half hour before daylight,
sure,
they would disappear into the jungle and melt away, you think. But when the sun comes up, I'll find those rascals. But they were hard to find, those truck parks. Where they dispersed and where they disappeared to, you'd probe around there, but they were hard to find. But there in the dry season, which started about October,
yeah.
I got there in late September, and by late October, the dry season started.
Sure.
And that's truck hunting season.
Certainly.
And that stayed until the monsoon started in late spring or early summer. I can't remember just when I started flying to prey formations, but it must have been shortly. It must have been late January. We had a covey and his prairie fire rider, John LaHecka, and Haymaker. We got shot down pretty close to 6019 in early January of 70.
And where was 6019 located then?
Straight west of Ben Het.
Oh, the AA camp that was under siege often.
Yeah, yes.
Sure.
Yeah, it was probably maybe 15 miles west of Ben Het.
Okay, sure.
Right there in the tri-border area.
Yeah. Historic battles at that AA camp. My goodness.
But it was a great place to close the road off. But we'd put strikes into the daytime to try to close slide the road off the side of a hill.
Right.
Some of the IDPs went around a cliff or on a side hill or across a ford. They'd have teams out there in the late evening, before dark. We had those roads back open. Bulldozers clearing them out. Here they come. They'd come screaming down the road.
And so, just so you don't mind for a minute, just to get back to talking about your night missions, can you, as you spent more time, can you remember nights where you had some success? So you, as the covey, you would look for a camp or whatever parking, then you'd light up the area. If you saw a potential target, you'd hit it,
and then you'd direct attack air on it? This is the year that we put a man on the moon. And here we were out there in Laos using tactics that Eddie Rickenbacker would have been familiar with.
Is that right, from World War One?
We were dropping a magnesium long marker, drop it off the wing, and it would pop, and when it hit the ground, there were logs about, I don't know, probably about that long and about 6 inches square. They'd burn with a very bright light. You would try to drop that where you had a bright light on the ground close to the head of the truck, the convoy,
right,
and try to put one at the tail end of the convoy. And then
to stop it in
primarily
place.
You were working wall-to-wall F4s.
Really?
The Navy launched everything. If there was a typhoon off the bow of the boat, they still launched everything they had on that boat. And we had a lot of Navy F-4s at night. And they're dropping Mark 82s with .025 or instantaneous fusing.
And what does that mean?
That with the after you hit the ground, it take 0.25 seconds before it detonates. You might use that for a road cut.
Sure.
Or instantaneous would be with a fuse extender.
We'd hit it on contact then.
Yes, and we try to use those instantaneous nearly all the time on trucks.
Sure.
Trying to get a wider spread of shrapnel. But you had to drop that Mark 82 within 50 meters of a truck to stop it. They had motor. It was a very inefficient way to kill trucks.
Were you able to improve the methods a little bit or not?
Once they got the gunships out there, they started off with AC-19s.
Right.
AC-119s.
Sure.
The old flying boxcars.
Right. You had the. They had two different variations. Could you start out with Spooky?
Spooky was a C-47. We didn't never use those.
And then they had two variations of the C-119 before they went to the Spectre.
Yeah.
Stingers.
Stinger was a C-130.
Oh, that was? Oh, I thought that was a 119.
Stinger, maybe Stinger. Spectre was a C-130.
Right, correct. Yes, sir.
Stinger might have been one of the call signs for the 119s. I remember Beatty was a call sign for one of the 119s because almost had a midair with all those boys one night.
No.
Out by Adipo.
No kidding. So what's that like? So you're busy concentrating on the trail and they're concentrating on the target and all of a sudden it's like we're getting too close?
I was with George Strand. George is a navigator. And he and I flew a lot together and he was very aggressive, very good. Got to work with at night. And we had a convoy out on, I believe they called that road Western 110. It was out south of Adipo in a big, broad, flat, grassy plains area south of the Zekong River. And one of the trucks of that convoy appeared to us to be a trailer truck. It had a long body on it.
Sure.
And we're working A7s. It was a night where there was no moon. It was very dark. And they're blowing up so much dust that the convoy is being obscured by dust. And I had the A7s holding high and dry, trying to wait the dust to clear, trying to pick up just where that convoy was again. And during the meantime, I knew this AC-119 was working out on the Zekong where it goes into Cambodia, in a far southwest area of our area. Because I'd seen him working down there, seen his tracers, and he was 10, 15, 20 miles away from us. And when they check into your area, I'm the sector fact. Anything that comes in there checks in with me.
Right.
So I told him he can work that area and we'll stay on his other area. But call me when you're RTB. He's supposed to call me, so he's going to return to base.
An RTB, right, yes, sir.
Going back to Da Nang. He didn't call me. And George and I are staggering around. George is looking out the window and trying to figure out just what happened to that convoy, trying to wait for the dust to clear. And something catches my eye, and I hear this. Those 119s had R4360s on them, huge radial engines.
Yeah.
And he goes over the top of me, and I can see in the cockpit. I can see the co-pilot and pilot in the cockpit, and I just slide under him maybe 10 feet.
No.
And I was just speechless. I poked George, and I point out the window because I couldn't talk. And all I could see was these two receding blue circles. It's the exhaust coming out of those 4360s.
Yeah, yeah.
Just receding in the distance, getting smaller. And George is looking at that and figure, what is that? Because he had heard this.
Sure.
Also, and I probably used some vulgarity. I said, that's that BB. I think his call sign was BB-19.
Whoa.
Did
you get some air shock too from off of that? No, really?
Nope. I'd blow his vortices. But I could hear him and I could see in the cockpit windows.
Oh my God.
See the green illumination of the instrument panel.
Sure. That is too close.
Oh, that was closest I ever had.
Yeah, I just can't imagine.
Yeah.
So, any luck with the longest, that longer trail? Did the dust ever clear to give you an opportunity to work it, or did you have to recover and get back to base after that close encounter?
I think we recovered. I don't remember if we ever had any secondaries, if we ever got that convoy. once in a while you had great success where you could kill one truck and it would start to burn and blow.
Right.
And then the fighters had something they could work with.
Sure.
And I remember we taught a convoy, seeming like it was south of the Broad and north of the Falls one time. And I don't remember who I was flying with. I don't know if it was George or not, but we got one of the trucks at the front of the convoy, and then we could work fighters, and we got several others. One of the most successful fighters we get would get the gunship escorts. After the gunship, they always had a set of F-4s out of U-Bahn as escort to the gunships.
For the C-119s?
119s and the yeah. C-130s. And this, when the gunships RTB went home, those F-4s had some fuel left. They'd send to us to expend the ordnance. And they carried CBU. And they had, forgotten the numbers, I think it was CBU 24 and 25. One of them was instantaneous and the other was delayed fuse. And they spread a pattern kind of like an oval with a donut hole in the middle of it. And you spread that over that truck, the instantaneous, and it would put holes in the fuel tanks, might flatten tires, and then you'd put an overlapping pattern of that CBU with the delay fusing. And that would go off for maybe 45 minutes or an hour.
Just really?
Where those little bombers would go off.
Sure.
Randomly, and that would start a fire. You'd set that fuel on fire, and it'd flow to the trucks, and you'd get the trucks burning and blowing. And had one or two real successful nights doing that. I remember one time we thought we'd run out of ordnance and fighters, and I was probably 3 miles away, slant range, kind of where the convoy that was burning was probably in my 5 o'clock position, about 3 miles. And one of those trucks blew up with a fireball that illuminated the cockpit, and the shock wave from that rocked our airplane. It went off like a nuke. we didn't know what that thing was carrying, but it was a hell of a secondary.
No kidding.
But flying at night was interesting. The first few times it was just terribly frightening because
I can't imagine.
They wouldn't shoot at you generally. When you're over a convoy with that O2, they would hear you.
Sure.
But they wouldn't shoot at you until the fighters showed up. But when they hear some F-4s overhead, then they'd light you up. And the first couple of nights they did that, it was such a light show that I thought, I can't survive this. You can't do this for a year.
yeah.
And get away with it. But once you got kind of used to it and you learned that you had to keep your head on a swivel and you needed to see the tracers ignite right away out of that out of that barrel.
Sure.
And if you were a mile away from them, had 5,500 foot slant range, especially on 37 millimeters, the muzzle velocity wasn't that fast on it, and it's slowing down all the way it's coming up. But you can see those tracers, and thank God they always use tracers. Or otherwise, you wouldn't know they were shooting at you until the airburst went off.
Right.
We always worked below the airburst. We didn't have enough power to get above it.
So take it, because now the airburst, again, for listeners that may not be familiar, this is like the World War II ACAC.
Yes.
Where you would see explosions in the air, and that was designed effectively, took out a lot of our B-17s and yeah. B-24s during World War II.
Yeah.
They had this kind of ordnance against y'all, And so you're saying if you were up at only 4,500 or 5,000 feet, the ACAC would be above you?
Yes. It would usually, the air burst altitude would usually be 7,500, 8,000 feet, somewhere maybe up as high as 9,000.
Oh, they couldn't adjust it downward?
Or if they could, they had to cut their fuses. I'm not sure how they probably cut the fuses to for a whole batch of ammo, but at any given night, you'd find the airbursts were always going up there around 7,500, 8,500 feet.
Oh,
and
Lord.
We seldom got up that high.
Yeah, I only encountered that once, and that was enough for a lifetime. It's just like, I can't imagine.
The most common gun out there was 37 millimeter. Once in a while, you'd come across a 23 millimeter.
Right.
Now, that was a different animal. That was a belt-fed weapon, had a real high muzzle velocity, and it come out of there looking like a fluorescent water hose.
Is that right?
It was scary.
Yeah.
A 37 millimeter was five round clips, as I recall. Always is a clip-fed weapon, five or seven rounds.
Okay. That's the first I've ever heard that. We all dreaded the 37 and the 23 Mike for sure. But I never heard about the five in one rack.
They were
ammo rack when they inserted. I'll be down.
But you run across the 23, and they had a weapon called a ZPU, which is a 14 and a half millimeter, I believe.
I'll take your word on that. This is Air Force talk.
They were a quad barrel. They were a four-barreled weapon.
Yeah.
And it had a horrendous rate of fire, even faster than the 23 millimeter. I don't think I ever run across one of those. I guess I was lucky in the time frame I was there.
Yeah.
Because not long after I came home, they ended up getting those handheld SA-7 missiles, Strela missiles. That put the low-level facts out of business.
No kidding.
The OB-10s, the O-2s.
So you lost, did you lose some O-2s in the process of learning that?
I think Art Moxon was the first guy that got shot down with one of those. He was an OV-10. He was a Da Nang Covey.
And so, if you don't mind, the time frame. So this is now early 1970.
No, Art got shot down. It's probably in 71.
Okay.
That's the first time. It was way into the Vietnamization. It's obvious that we were losing the war big time by then. I came home in September of 70, right. That Operation Tailwind, I had already had my Finney flight.
Oh, is that right?
And I quit flying, and I was in the process of packing my bags, getting ready to out-process.
Sure.
And they were running out of Prairie Fire qualified guys that asked me if I would do that, and I did. And the day we extracted them, I got back to play two after the rest of the guys landed at Kontum. I refueled at Dock Tow, I think, and went and didn't go to Kontum, where the rest of the team landed. I refueled at Dock Tow and went to play coup, and that was it. The very next day, I caught a flight to Da Nang and out-processed.
You packed your duffel bag.
And I never heard any more about the Tailwind.
Wow.
For 28 years. I didn't know how successful it was.
Yeah.
I knew that we were very lucky to get everybody out, that there was 16 Americans and everyone was wounded. There was about 50 of the yards that were wounded and three of them were killed. But for a hatchet force or a prairie formation of that size,
sure,
it was very successful. That's all I knew. And then I got a call from the Pentagon in 98 asking if I remembered anything about Tailwind. No, that name doesn't ring a bell because I hadn't seen the CNN report.
Right, sure.
Or seen that.
Well then, let us, if you don't mind, for the purpose of the story, we have your experiences flying at night, and then by 1970, you're getting close to derosing, going home.
Early 70, I started flying prairie fire missions.
Okay. Say that again, I'm sorry.
Early 70, probably in late January, February, I started flying the prairie fire missions.
Okay, which is different than night missions, knocking out trucks on the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Prairie fire missions were just a SOG support.
Sure, okay, very good. Thank you for that clarification.
And we always had an experienced, seasoned 1-0 in the right seat. They were called a prairie fire rider.
Right, and we always called them Covey riders. So you had a Covey who's the Air Force pilot of an O-2.
He was in the right, and we were always using O-2s until the summer of 70. And in about July of 70, they started using the OV-10s.
Right. And that wasn't, I mean, that was, from my experience with Covey riders, they liked the O-2 because you're side by side. You could see each other, talk to each other, hand maps, papers back and forth. But how was that from your perspective as the pilot?
Well, I didn't fly the OV-10 as in prairie fire support.
Okay.
But the O-2, it was so handy to have that guy sitting right beside you. He could point to that
map
and show me they're in here. And the OV-10, he couldn't even pass that Mac from the back seat to the front. We could do hand signals. We could point to each other. I thought the O-2 was a better aircraft for those prairie fire missions.
Sure.
But I think some of the riders got to where they liked the OV-10 much more because it had some limited offensive capability. It had M60 machine guns into sponsons, and it carried pods of rockets on each wing.
Yeah, for the 2.75s.
So it could use their pistol a little bit, and O2 didn't have anything. All the thing you could do is maybe squirt some Willie Pete's at them. And the OV-10 was faster. And had ejection seats, so it's infinitely more survivable.
And I also have to tell you that the OV-10, even when it was like descending, so you gain some airspeed, it always seems so slow.
Well,
and
they were.
I'm surprised you didn't lose
slow,
more.
We've staggered around out there to save fuel. You always had that O2 pulled back. I'm usually indicating about 85, 90 knots.
Right.
I forgot what the fuel flow was, but you had it leaned way out where the cylinder head temps were hot, and you're running lean trying to save some gas.
Sure. And again, the O2 had two engines. Had an engine in the front and an engine in the back.
It was a Cessna 337.
Was that what it was?
Cessna 337.
Okay, yeah, we always called them O2s.
they're called the O2A, which was the FAC version. They had an O2B, which was a psi warfare mission that they used down in the low country, down around Saigon, I think.
So at some point, you get a briefing for Operation Tailwind, even though they may not have called it that at the time. Which, and for the time frame here, we're talking they actually launched on September the 11th, but a few days, or maybe as much as a week earlier, they had planned, but there was weather and issues that held them back. And
they tried to stage out a dock tow a time or two. And
correct.
I believe the first
dock
day
tow was a launch site for CCC targets that went into Laos.
Yes. Khon Tum was almost straight north of Pleiku, about 25 miles. Dock tow was up the highway, which turned into Highway 110 in Laos.
Right.
And Dock Tow was probably 20 miles from the Laotian border, maybe.
Okay.
And then Ben Het was further west of Dock Tow, and it was probably maybe 10 miles from the border.
Yeah, and Ben Het was a Special Forces A camp that was designed to put there to try to interdict the trail and also to give intel about enemy movement, as were many other aid camps along the border. Yeah. But over time, Ben Het became really historic for the number of times that the NVA tried to overrun it.
Yes. We couldn't land and take off at Ben Het. If I was in an emergency, I would land there, but I wouldn't be able to have, I didn't have enough runway to take off. You could land an O2 a lot shorter than you could take it off.
Oh, is that right?
Now,
okay.
You could probably have gotten an OV-10. They were a good short field airplane. O2 was a dog. It had Continental IO-360Ds, 210 horse engines.
210?
210 horsepower each. It wouldn't move out of its own state.
That's not much. That's not too much bigger than a Volkswagen.
No.
I'm kidding you a little bit.
It was a piddle machine to send your kid to war in.
Yeah. So as you're thinking about, oh, my deer roast is getting really close, meaning the time I'm going to go home, somebody comes to you and says, Gary, we got a good deal for you. We got an operation coming up here. I don't know if they call it Operation Tailwind or not, but how did all this begin to come to your mind?
Well, I'd worked a lot of prairie formations all from probably February on. I didn't fly at night very often.
Okay.
It was primarily
like you said, you had a new assignment.
Yeah.
And what was that like? I mean, was that an eye-opener too?
I enjoyed it. It was exciting. I was in awe of those recon teams, just in awe of the courage and the guts and the ability they had. We would put them in some of the damnedest places out there, and they would ENA through the woods and get into firefights and fight your way out and get into a DLZ, and we'd pull them out and using A1s and Cobras, and then the slicks come in to pull them out. I guess I was lucky, and I never had a team that was completely annihilated.
Really?
We had one, that must have been about March of 70. I remember Steve Brown was the FAC on that. I don't remember who his rider was. I think maybe it was Durango, Lloyd O'Daniels. I wouldn't swear to that. RT Pennsylvania. Had a hot extraction. Got the team. I think there was an 8-man team. Got him on that slick. Pulled him out of that LZ and just got up about level the treetops from starting to go through, trying to with the tip it over and trying to pick up translational lift. And
yeah.
They got hit with a B-40 rocket right through the door, and it blew that thing to smithereens.
Oh.
Killed all three guys on the slick and the entire team. It was just, I never had that heartbreak happen to me. I was always lucky, and we were able to get the teams out. But
sure. That's a real bad day in Prairie Fire AO.
Yes.
Absolutely.
As I recall, that's the only team during my 12 months there, the only team that we lost the entire team on.
Right.
We had several. We had guys killed.
Sure.
And lots of them wounded. There may have been others that I can't, that's the only one I can remember that
sure.
We lost the whole team on.
And then what, I mean, this is why I'm enjoying our interview, because as a Covey pilot, what was it like to say, okay, now I need some A1s, you would give them the direction. So if a team's on the ground and they're saying I'm in contact, so you're able, you have to pinpoint where the team is. And once you pinpoint the team, which sometimes can be quite difficult, particularly if you're in that tri-border, you still had triple canopy in some spots. Sometimes maybe just double or single.
the most effective way to spin point was they would use a hits with a shiny,
right?
That signal mirror, and then you knew exactly where they were.
They tell you bingo.
Yeah. There were times where they'd put out a panel. The only color panels that I can remember were kind of a
like
international day glow orange.
And so here, from my perspective as a guy on the ground, I can't believe you guys could actually see those panels. That's amazing to me to think that you're
up
there.
How big were they?
Well, we had different sizes. Some guys cut them down. Some people put them in their hat, which I don't think anybody could see other than their grandmother. But they had bigger panels, would be like a 3x3, and maybe a little bit bigger.
I was guessing they were probably 6x6. The only one occasion where I remember picking one up.
Yeah.
When John LaHecca and Haymaker were shot down, we got LaHecca's body out that day. It was a month or 6 weeks later that we went in to get Haymaker's body, because
really?
We knew where the wreckage was.
Yeah, yeah. They went down on 02?
Yes.
Okay.
And we put a bright light team in and ended up being a hot extraction on that. And one of the team members that didn't have a radio, I think he was a yard, we got the rest of the team out, and he'd gotten separated. And they called us up. The rest of them were heading back to Doctoe and said, we're missing one guy. There's still one guy left on the ground. He didn't have a radio. So, again, I think I was with Lloyd O'Daniels. And we started looking for him. And northeast of 6019, along that stream bed, and there were some large grassy areas where there was high elephant grass out there, and we thought he might be in that area. And I had to get down on the deck to go hunting for that. You're not going to see that from 4,500 feet.
No.
I remember making several passes, and then I just happened to look down, and I got a glimpse of that,
really?
That panel.
Yeah.
And we scrambled a couple assets out of Doctoe, went back out there and picked that boy up.
No.
And I don't know who he was.
Yes.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient. Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
I don't have any idea, but I know I saved that boy's life that day because I saw his panel.
No kidding. That's amazing. Yeah, well, we carry him, that's for sure. And I always thought, like, it can't be big enough for anybody to see. But the mirror, it took a while sometimes, but yeah. It was quiet
yeah.
and quick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And well, you can see it a long way.
Yes.
You can see that if he puts that shiny on you, you can pick that up a long way off.
Yeah, we're
and if he's going to pop a colored smoke, first of all, the NVA was listening to our radios. He said they're going to pop a smoke.
never give the color.
Never give the color.
So you had to confirm it.
I see red smoke. Is that you?
Yeah.
But red smoke against that jungle, hard to see.
Sure. But yep. The yellow or the white.
Yellow or the white, the bad guys of Pop Smoke too.
Sure, oh yeah, absolutely. We had that. They would guess, because we worked like you just said. I'm popping smoke, then we'd wait for you to say what you saw.
Yeah.
And then once you said that, because sometimes there'd be more than one, say, well, which one are you looking at? And maybe come back with another spoke, just change the color quickly.
That's
the first part, under enemy fire. They're coming at us, and we're trying to link to you to get that ground, the all-important air support, that close air support.
To be effective, to give you any help with air support, I know I have to know exactly where you are.
Sure.
And I could bring A1s and Cobras in really close. But if I had to rely on F4s, man, it's not safe to have them in the same county. But F100s are a little bit better.
Really?
F100s, yeah. Well, first of all, the guard troops, those litter flights out of Tuiwa, were Air National Guard troops. Those boys have been flying that F-100 for 10 years. They were very good with it.
Okay.
And you had a lot of kids in those F-4s that were right out of pilot training. That they were doing good for their bombs to hit the ground.
I've never heard it put that way before.
I've seen some of those F-4 sling them into the wrong country.
Oh, no. Well, let's move along to Operation Tailwind, Gary. So when did you get your first notice? Gary, we know you're packing your bag to go home, but we got one more mission for you. And how'd that start, sir? And again, for our listening audience, in September of 1970, the CIA was involved in a major operation in the further west into Laos, along the plateau in southern Laos. And Premier Sihanouk had left Cambodia earlier in 1970, and the North Vietnamese were pushing thousands of troops south to take over Cambodia. And they do it in a very clandestine fashion, coming through Laos. But the CIA had a force of several thousand, but they were losing. So who did they call? They called SOG. And they said, we need a diversion to help draw away the NVA troops from our operation here, help. And so they come to CCC, they dub it Operation Tailwind, and the plan is to have a platoon from Khartoum of 116 Montagnard Hatchet Force, along with 16 Green Berets. It's 120 Montagnard, 16 Green Berets. And there was 2 or 3 days they tried to launch, but bad weather, they couldn't. Finally, on the morning of September 11th, again, because the target was so far west, it was outside of the normal prairie fire area of operation. It was west. And they launched out of Dak To. They used Marine Corps CH-53 Deltas, which could carry a lot more troops. And they conveyed them in, took them to the target area. And one of the helicopters, upon insertion, had 2 or 3 wounded indigenous troops that were returned to base. Now, under any ordinary circumstance, when a team would go in, like a recon team, if we took incoming fire, we're compromised, we're not going on the ground. But that day, that team inserted, continued on with the mission. So where do you fit into that, sir?
You had a lot more in briefing than we had. As a covey, I was a first lieutenant. I'm so low on the totem pole there. The only thing we're told is what we need to know to do our part of the mission.
Sure,
that's
okay.
That's what's called compartmentalized intelligence.
Indeed, yes, sir.
If I don't know it, I can't talk about it.
Yeah.
I had no idea until 1998 that Tailwind was put in there as a diversion for a CIA operation. I never heard anything about that.
Right.
We were never told, as a covey, what the objective of any team that I put in I didn't know what those guys were going to do.
Sure.
They told me, we want you to put this team into this ballpark. We called at a ballpark was 6 kilometers on a side, 36 square kilometers.
6 by 6, yeah.
You guys go find an LZ to put this team in. And we're going to play that ball game on such and such day.
Sure.
So I'd go out there and I'd find LZs that we thought might be usable.
Sure.
And I'd put the team in. They never told me, well, this team is going in there for a wiretap, or he's going in there to go try to block the road, or he's going in there for a prisoner snatch. I didn't know what they were going in there for. And if we pulled them out, I never was told what their success was.
Or if they were successful or not.
What
did
they find?
Yeah.
We never got briefed on what kind of intel, but at least I wasn't.
And,
I wasn't involved with picking out the LZs to put Tailwind in. Those guys were put in, I believe, by George Bomer. He was flying OV-10.
Right.
They started flying OV-10s for prayer fire support, I think, in July. But they only had just a couple of the guys that were Prairie Fire qualified in the OV-10. And George was one. I don't remember who else might have been.
Mm-hmm.
But they were in the process of converting over from O2s to OV-10s. And I think they put them in there on, what you say, the 11th?
Yes, sir.
And I think it may have been on the 12th. They were all the way on the ground when they came to me and said, we're running out of prairie fire facts. Would you go do this? So, yeah, what's going on up there? I'll go up there and do what
I
can.
Yeah, so just for a little more background on that, on the first night, well, when the team first got on the ground, within an hour, they came across an enemy cache.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if you heard anything about that or not.
Nope.
Because that first day, they came across the enemy cache. It was huge. They marked it. They set it up.
And blew it up.
And they, before they blew it up, they had a phone call. There was a telephone in there, and the commander was Captain Gene McCarley. The phone rang. He picked up the telephone and goes, "Hello, 5th Special Forces Group. May I help you?" It's one of those golden sog moments in history. And I'm not sure what Ho Chi Minh's boys said, but they must have been a little startled to hear Captain Gene McCarley on the phone. And so they came back, blew up the cache, weapons, food, supply, got some intel from the headquarters there, and then they moved out. And the part of that mission was, where earlier we were talking about the SLAM operations that Covey supported, because you blocked the trail, then the NVA would attack with great vigor on that team on the ground. The Air Force was there to support them with the attacks against the team. Here, Captain McCarley said, "We're going in, we're going to move day and night, we're not going to sit on one spot." And he did it with support from the Air Force, and they did include their movement. And that first night, the command post was in a meeting, and a B-40 rocket came in, flew past them and hit some vegetation, exploded backwards, wounding the medic, Gary Mike Rose. He had wounds in his hands, to which affects his hand to this day, and some of the shrapnel cut off his jungle, cut into the jungle boot, and he wrapped it up with a bandage because other people were wounded. He went back to tending to the wounded. So that was Gary Mike Rose's story. So for day two, Gary gets the call. "What's the good call to you, sir? We need a senior prairie fire
fact." I hopped in the O2 and I went up to Kontum and picked up a prairie fire rider. I don't know who that was. I think maybe it was Bill Grimes Country.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been Larry White. It may have been Ken Carpenter. Six pack. Larry White was six pack. Ken Carpenter was shoebox.
Okay.
But I've flown with all those guys. I think he probably briefed me en route. I picked him up and I think we launched out of Khantoum and motored up there. Got on scene and probably took over from another covey and relieved him.
Right.
Because he'd probably out of gas, and started working that team.
I mean, how often did you guys end up flying on fumes? Because you hung over to teams as long as you could sometimes. And that was always a major challenge.
It was. I remember almost running out of gas the day we pulled those guys out.
Oh, really?
I was running on fumes. I can remember landing at dock tow a couple of times and climbing up on a ladder to look into the tank.
Yeah.
And you can see the bottom of the tank, and the bottom of the tank isn't even wet.
Is that right?
So I just had what fuel was left in the lines, basically.
Sure. So anyway, day two, you're flying north, you get briefed, you get on target. What was it like from your perspective in your O2 looking down at Operation Tailwind as they're moving and enemy contact?
Well, I could locate where they were all the time, and they had already had a prairie fire emergency declared, so we had priority for air. But the weather was so stinky; it was still a monsoon season.
Right.
You had to pick your way down through sucker holes in the clouds to get down to under the deck. It was really tough to work any fast movers. So you're having to work the Spads and the Cobras, because you can get them, if the Cobras are out to above a cloud deck, I'm slow enough, or they're faster than I am.
Really?
I don't think I can outrun a Cobra.
That's too funny.
They could follow me down through a sucker hole.
Sure.
And I could do the same thing with the A1s.
Yeah.
Get them down there and working under a fairly low ceiling there. What I can remember is just working the edges of where the team was and trying to keep them moving. And seemingly like it was always a westerly direction.
Yes.
It seemed like we were always heading them west, southwest. There were some open areas up there. It's not all triple cannibal jungle up there.
Right.
Because that was at high altitude. I can't remember specifically what happened that day. One of my more vivid memories is working, I think, the next day. Because these guys were running low on ammo.
Low on
ammo? They already used a lot of their claymores. They wanted claymores. And they needed some gas masks. Because the gas masks had either been discarded or gotten wet.
Right.
They needed some gas masks. And they needed claymores and ammo. So that night, we conjured
from night
up,
two, they were planning, because I know on I day three, they
it.
Also had day three, they planned to come in to pick up the wounded, because they had couple heavily wounded Montagnards team members that they literally carried. And then also there was a need for resupply.
That we picked up some wounded out of there.
Well, they tried, but they couldn't. That was what happened when the CH-53 came in, and it was just hovering. The tailgate went down, and Doc Patchett was on it, and Mike Rose, the medic on the ground, and some of the team members were just getting ready to lift up the first wounded. It got hit by enemy ground fire of some sort, and it severely damaged the aircraft. So it had to take off, left the team, and then that helicopter went a short distance away and
went
had
about
an emergency
miles south
landing.
And augured in.
Right.
And crashed.
So then another CH-53 came back with a ladder down, and those crew members climbed up on the ladder, and there's that historic scene of that CH-53 flying back with the Marine Corps Scarface gunships flying escort alongside of them, heading back to base.
With a bunch of guys hanging on the ladder.
Yes, sir. They're all on that ladder,
yeah.
Including Doc Paget.
Yeah.
So that part was going on. But the other side, you're thinking about their need from the resupply.
Yeah.
So let's get back to that, and then the not quite successful effort.
I don't know who came up with the idea.
Not due
I think
to you.
I think it was one of the Covey writers that suggested putting those duffel bags in the back of that OV-10, taking the door off. The OV-10 had the capability to carry, I believe, 8 paratroops in that cargo compartment behind the rear.
I don't think
cockpit.
It was 8, but they could carry a few, maybe 4 or 5. It was always tight.
It was a pretty big compartment back there.
But you could carry supplies.
Yes, you could carry supplies.
Sure.
So they packed these bags, lashed them together, and they were going to use a drogue chute,
right.
Like they used for pulling pallets out of a C-130 on a
Yeah, which
a
you're
lakes.
Familiar with. The parachute opens,
yeah.
It pulls out the load, and then the parachute's supposed to hold it up, and then the load gently goes to the ground to
well,
at least
they had
gently
one of those,
enough to survive.
They had one of those chutes up there at Cantu, probably been laying around for 3 years.
Oh, no.
And put it on there, and Colonel McGraw was our detachment commander, wonderful, great guy, and he thought this was such a high-risk endeavor with the O2, and George is going to fly. McGraw says, I'm going to be in your back seat.
Really?
And I was the fact for them, and I was going to work them just like a fighter. I had the team in a pretty good-sized LZ, a pretty grassy area. I was using the Cobras and I think A1s on either side of that strafe and using nails and suppressing the ground fire, and called them in. Here they come in from south to north over the team, and George knew where the team was.
Sure.
So when he gets up, he's going to pitch up, and Weird is going to boot those bags out the back. And all that worked fine, and that parachute just snapped out there, and I remember that thing just went up in kind of a green cloud of dust.
Oh, no.
And those bags go, going flying across that LZ.
The parachutes totally fell apart.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So instead of just dropping on the chute, there was a stream down there, and then there was this east-west ridge line and that side hill up there, just alive with gunfire. And that blivet lands right in the middle of it.
No.
Because we were going to use gas on them to help that extraction, but those guys need the gas.
Yeah, they're going to use CS gas.
Now the bad guys are going to have the gas mask and all those claymores.
Right.
The ammo probably didn't mean that much to them because they didn't have any shortage of that.
Right.
But those claymores they had, and I probably worked 30 minutes putting fighters on that hillside. CBU and napalm, and
were you able to? Do you think, to the best of your ability, able to direct enough attack air on that to destroy what the erroneous drop?
Well, we put enough on there to silence a lot of those muzzle flashes. You didn't see so much ground fire coming across there. They were keeping their heads down.
Yeah,
but I don't know what happened to that bag of goodies.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so this is day 3.
I think that was
at the end of day 3. Again, they moved that night. They had Spectre over them.
Yep.
They had contact each and every night.
Yep.
And on day 4, they wanted to continue on with the mission, and they wanted to try to get the medevac. Well, this is what before they had the reality check for Covey. They were planning to continue on, try another medevac to get the wounded out, and maybe get some resupplies. But Covey comes in and says, bad news, we got severe weather coming our way. It's time to think about extraction.
We had a break in the weather. We had good weather coming in, good enough to use fighters
mm-hmm.
before that front came in and sock us in again. We've been dealing with bad weather the entire time.
No kidding.
And we had an opportunity here to be able to use those fast movers. Maybe there was a scheme to resupply them, keep them going. But by that time, they had so many guys wounded.
Yeah.
We were needing to pull them out.
Well, I don't know if it was you, but one of the Covey riders pretty early in the morning said, be advised, there's the huddled masses heading south. There's hundreds, maybe over 1,000 NVA coming your way. So in combination with the wounded, the weather, and Buku VC NVA coming with them getting low on ammo, the decision was made, it's time to exfil.
Yeah.
And so at what time did you arrive on the scene, sir, if you can recall? I mean, you were there for a part of it, you said you were there for the last extract, right? The last helicopter.
I was there for the extract, and I'm not sure what time of day that was. I would say mid to late afternoon.
So what is it like when you come on scene? There's bad weather, they're still in contact.
The weather was getting better. It was breaking up.
Oh, is that right?
The weather was breaking up.
But by that time, you had any helicopters left
yet?
I was replacing. Yeah.
But he had air stacked up to probably 30,000 feet. And we had another FAC that was checking in the fighters. One of the things when a Hillsborough or Moonbeam would send a set of fighters to the FAC, he would send them to contact Covey FAC on such and such frequency and a rendezvous point, and he'd get them attack in.
Yeah, and again, just for our listeners, the Hillsborough or Moonbeam was a night command and control center.
Airborne command
Air
control.
Burn, yes, sir. Command control center.
And they're the one that dispersed all the air. So they would send these fighters to the FAC. The FAC is supposed to write down their call sign, their mission number, their lineup, what ordnance they have, and how much playtime they have. And then the FAC is supposed to brief them on what the target is, what the elevation is, what the AAA threat is, best bailout areas, best recovery base, and all that.
Sure.
It takes a lot of time.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't have time to do that, so we had a high FAC that was taking all that. And if I needed somebody with 20 millimeter strafe, I'd call him and say, send me some strafe. I need, I need some napalm. I need
sure.
some CBU. Or he might have some of the 533 gunfighter 1-2 flight, just has 10 bus fuel. Can you use their marketed twos? Sure, I can use marketed twos. I could
sure.
Sling them down a mile or so from the team. In an area where I suspected there was
enemy activity. Sure.
I didn't want to take them and put them in the ocean.
yeah.
But whatever I needed, I'd call up there and get, and then they'd check out with a high FAC. And so I didn't even keep track of how many sets of fighters I put in that day, but probably 20. I know I can remember 105s. A-7s, A-4s, F-4s, Navy.
No kidding.
F-4s, Air Force. Everything except the Coast Guard. Everything except Coast Guard.
Yeah. So were you Covey when they called for the A-1 Sky Raider from NKP to come in and drop CS? Or through
yes,
the CBU, CS?
I worked... it's probably a hobo or Zorro.
And those are the call signs for A1 Sky Raiders out of Thailand.
Out of Thailand, the A1s out of NK or out of Da Nang just use SPAD call
right.
sign. And I think they were probably hobos or Zorros out of NKP. That's
true.
We used it. It was gas.
And so at that point,
let's say gas.
CS
gas.
Tear gas.
Yeah.
Yes. And so at that point, the contact of the team was serious enough that you felt the necessity for that ordinance.
Yeah.
And also at one point, there was one Sky Raider who was between Coveys. He talked directly to the team leader, and they had one of those wave assaults coming against the team. He was able to break through and to make several gun runs that broke the back of that wave attack. And his name was Tom Stump. But I don't know what his call sign would be. I don't know if you remember anything like that or not?
No, I don't.
Okay, so then you recall the CS, though.
Yeah.
And then when they brought that in, by that time, had there been any of the helicopters been in for, they had a total of three. So they had one came in with minimal gunfire. The second one came in with a little bit more gunfire from the enemy before the third. And that's the one that you were the cubby rider, cubby observing that all the way through.
The one that I remember the most vividly.
Sure.
Was the one that got the last of the team on board.
Right.
And he was hit hard coming off the LZ. And he had an engine either out or damaged. So he's flying basically on one engine at high altitude with a heavy load. And he was staggering off to the east. And there's that arroyo that's steep, extremely steep sides and deep with a little stream on bottom of it that went probably 30 miles down to the southeast. And he was heading over in that direction, and there was another CH-53, and I told him to follow him because I thought he could put down over there and pick him up.
This is after the second engine went out?
Well, he hadn't lost the second engine yet.
Okay.
But I was about to lose an engine because I was so low on gas that I wasn't sure. I thought I might have to put it down at Doc Peck or Doc Siang because I was so low on gas.
Yeah, okay.
So I was heading southeast toward Doc Peck and Doc Siang, which is just north of Doc Peck.
Sure.
And I told the other CH-53 to follow that guy. And I could see them off in the distance, probably 3 or 4 miles, what he called, he had lost his second engine. And at this point, I was feeling so elated. Wow, we pulled this off. We got him out.
Right.
Wow, what a great feeling that is.
Yeah.
I lost the second engine now going in, and he's got all these guys on board. And phew, he goes down in that gorge, and I could see him disappear.
Really?
Down into that gorge. And I figured there wouldn't be anything left but hair, teeth, and eyes. But they hit the ground hard.
Oh, they did.
And, but the other helicopter was right there and got them out. And before I got to Doc Toe, I heard them call. They got everybody out, and it was a successful
mission,
and they were all RTB to Khantoum.
Right. Because earlier in the day they did hit another cache, and then the other part of that drama was when that helicopter was lifting off, the one you observed lifting off, one of the young Marine door gunners gets shot in the neck and his blood is streaming out, and the medic goes over, begins to tend to him, and that was Gary Mike Rose, saved his life as they're going up, and the second engine went out. They had to do that emergency training, and they never had trained, I mean, emergency landing. They never trained for a full helicopter, fully loaded, with engine failure. And this pilot did it on his own. It was just like one of those amazing moments in time.
Yeah.
And to think that everybody lived, of course, Captain Gene McCarley, when the as you said, it was a rough impact, it was so rough, it crushed his teeth when he got knocked out of the helicopter. He and Mike Rose and several others were literally thrown from the helicopter as they regained consciousness.
And one of the yards was killed when I think that helicopter rolled over.
Well, they also had one with Gene McCarley said that when they were loading the helicopter after the CS run, because the CS was in the air, the NVA were still coming, but now they're disoriented. He had a Montyard standing next to him who was killed right there. And they took his body and were able to return him. And Gene was like one of those stunning moments. Right. You know, around the bed 4 or 5 inches at a different angle. So they saved him. And the NVA came up, they kept waiting for him to throw a hand grenade into the helicopter. But the CS had so disoriented him, he did such a good job of getting the CS down there that he didn't, and they were able to lift off. under heavy fire, of course. Yeah. Just an amazing day. So any other thoughts about that day? Because this is one of those moments in time, a historic SOG mission.
I pretty much forgot all about that because, like I said, I left Pleiku the next day.
Packed your rucksack and went home.
Yeah. Turned my stuff in, and I was anxious to get to Da Nang and get on the Freedom Bird and go home and put that behind me.
Sure.
And I'd retired from the Air Force, and I was flying for Delta in 98 when that tailwind Valley of Death.
And we're talking about a production that came out on CNN, the Communist News Network, and then a week later it was followed up by Time Magazine.
And they were talking about Operation Tailwind, which the tailwind didn't ring a bell with me. Every one of those ball games had we had Spin Down and Ashtray 1 and Ashtray 2.
These are the slam operations.
Yeah.
Sure.
And every prayer fire mission had a different code name. So that didn't mean anything to me. And the story that I heard was so preposterous that they were using sarin nerve gas. I thought, well, wasn't anything I had anything to do with. So I hadn't seen the TV program. I hadn't read the magazine. And so in 98, I got a call from Dr. Thompson from the Air Force History Office at the Pentagon. And he left a note with my wife. Regardless of what time I get home from this trip, give him a call. You know, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I didn't call him. I thought, what is that about? So I called him, and if I remember, Operation
Yes, 28 Taylor. Years later, for cat's sake.
I said, I think I remember a little bit about that. What about it? And it caused such a stink that there's an investigation, and I haven't got a call from some CNN reporter. I decided I didn't want to talk to him. So I guess I'm making excuses for why my memory is so foggy and dim. I didn't realize Tailwind was such a big deal.
Sure.
I'd never heard that it was the biggest intel coup of the war.
From the SOG side of things.
Yeah.
That was not all, the biggest, one of the biggest for sure.
That was all news to me.
Yeah. you had gone home.
And
just for the record here.
Don't think that I'm the only covey that's involved. We just don't know who those other guys were.
Right.
And I don't know how to find them and track them down.
Well, that's why we're glad to get you here today, Gary. Absolutely. But also, just for our audience again, the Communist News Network first came out with the story that cast aspersions on the operation, essentially saying that it wasn't CS, which is the regular tear gas. They said it was a nerve gas.
When I read that report, and I've got a copy of it down in my room. I've got a bunch of documents I should have brought up here to show you. Any high school journalism student would have got a failing grade if they turned in a report like that.
Indeed.
And it was so preposterous to think that April Oliver and Peter Arnett had a good reputation.
At that time. Sure.
And they were, to put their names on a story like that, my God, what were they thinking?
Well, they were trying to compete with 60 Minutes, and they wanted to come out with a major story, and they twisted it so that they made it say not only was it not tear gas, but it was sarin nerve gas, and that they're going for American dissidents. And of course, with any good leftist publication, they killed innocent women and children, which was so far from the fact of the matter, talking about the success of the operation.
Innocents in that part of Laos.
No, let alone women or children.
No, there were no tribesmen up there. They scattered.
Yeah.
Anything that was human on the ground up there was a bad guy.
Absolutely. And so, and the CIA guys are fighting their battle a little further west even, for sure, which you didn't know about, but that was all part of it.
I knew about the Raven program, the Raven facts. We had several of our guys from Pleiku that went to the Raven program, and in fact, I would have volunteered and gone to that Raven program, mm-hmm. as working for Vang Pao, but I was enjoying flying prey fire so much, I would have had to put in my extension papers, mm-hmm. extend for 6 months. I would have had to do that by, I think, the 15th of July. There was a deadline,
right.
And I missed that deadline. I would have.
You would have missed Operation Tailwind without knowing.
I would have. Yeah.
And then, last but not least, the way these things unfold with time, it's just amazing. And I'm trying to get back to the point on this Operation Tailwind. They were competing, and you got your phone call from the Pentagon when they began to put together a very serious effort to A, find out what really happened,
yeah.
find as many people to get the facts straight to refute the lies and that were printed and published on the Communist News Network.
Well, I know how Dr. Thompson got my name to call me.
Really, how?
Ed Eberhardt was the vice chief of staff of the Air Force at that time. He was a 4-star.
Okay.
He was in the class behind me in pilot training.
Really?
And he ended up at Play Coup. I was I was a month or two ahead of him. He was a prey fire fact also. And so I think that he recognized, excuse me a second, he recognized that Operation Tailwind, and
he remembered you were there.
And yeah, Ed and I were close friends. We were stationed at Vance flying T-38s together, and I ran into him a couple of times later in my Air Force career. And he said, I think Gary Green was the fact that was working on that. And Cohen was the Secretary of Defense at that time.
Right.
That was during the Clinton administration.
Yes, sir.
And Cohen wanted a thorough investigation of this. If this is true, we're going to hang some folks.
Yes.
And so Ed was probably trying to cover tracks and said, I think Gary Green was involved in that. And when I got to thinking about it, I thought, I think Ed was a high fact for me that day. I think he was working that. But I called him and talked to him and says, oh no, I was on R&R in Hawaii when that was going on.
Okay.
Plus, at that time, he and Larry Meredith and Obie O'Brien were working a project called Salem House, which was the
Cambodia.
SOG operation in Cambodia.
Sure.
He wasn't working the Kontum lotion program that much. He was down there. I knew something was going on called Salem House. I didn't know what it was.
Sure. That was a Cambodian version of Prairie Fire.
Yes, it was.
Yes, sir.
But that's how my name came up. There are other guys that might have been involved with that. Gary Owen was a Prairie Fire fact. Larry Smith was a Prairie Fire fact. I can't remember any of the others who that might have been involved.
Sure.
I wish you could find them, because I don't want to be the only one getting their story screwed up here.
You're not screwed up. I think you've done quite well. And it's a unique side of this operation to hear from your perspective, from the big eye in the sky looking down on the battleground, even in bad weather.
Well, one of the things that really made me want to come out to this special ops reunion is that I've never run across any of those guys since the war to talk to them. But I'd love to have talked to Larry White or O'Daniels or maybe you, somebody that ran those recon for years, kept extending and doing that time after time after time. The incredibly high risk and the loss rate. The time you run 10 or 20 recon missions, you're living on borrowed time.
Absolutely.
Why did you guys keep doing that?
Young and dumb, like the Air Force policy, kept extending their tours of duty flying hazardous missions across the prairie fire in North Vietnam.
I think it's relatively the same, sir. It was kind of an adrenaline rush.
Well, there's a little bit of that too, yes, sir. I think there's some common ground here, Gary.
I don't think I was nuts.
Hey, with all due respect, sir, anybody flying night missions along the Ho Chi Minh Trail for first time without much experience other than I'm a good pilot, I think that's a little bit nuts, quite frankly, sir. And I tip my beret to you for that, absolutely.
You know, if you'd had to depend on majors and lieutenant colonels to do that, I don't think you'd have gotten the job done. They had too much sense. But a 22-year-old guy doesn't have brains to
right.
pour piss out of a boot with top written on a heel.
Well, look, so any other tailwind thoughts? If not, then just a quick thumbnail as we kind of head down the trail to wrap this up, Gary. What about the... You said you had a career 20 years with the Air Force?
Yeah.
And then you got your adrenaline rush flying for Delta, or which airline?
Delta.
Okay.
I retired on the 29th day of February of 88, uh-huh. leap year.
Indeed.
And started class with Delta on the 4th of March. And I flew for Delta for another 50 and a half years and then retired.
Outstanding.
I've had a charmed life.
Well, you survived the Ho Chi Minh Trail and that anti-aircraft, the AC-AC, so God bless you.
Yeah.
Well, we're at that point, sir. Any final thoughts at all before we wrap it up for tonight?
How many of the tailwind, of the 16 Americans, how many of them are left? I know Gene died, Planchet died.
There's only a couple that we know of. If the one for sure is the, which we haven't stated yet, which was the Green Beret medic, was Gary Mike Rose, who was a sergeant on that mission. He was wounded that night.
Yeah.
And he uses CAR 15 as a crutch for the missions. And, he was able to patch up all the people that were wounded, except for the one that was killed that last day with the Captain McCarley. And they may have had to leave one other KIA body behind that may have died the second day. I'm not sure about that part. We'll know more tomorrow. But on October 23rd, 2017, at the White House, President Donald J. Trump awarded Mike the Medal of Honor. And Mike is here for this reunion. He'll be here for the presentation tomorrow. I'm not quite sure what his role is going to be in it, but he is here. He's the only man left that I know of from the Green Beret side that's
really?
Still alive. Yes, sir.
Got him. Well, we had a reunion in 98 up at Houghton, Michigan. You mm-hmm. were there. General Singlob was there.
That was 2004.
Was that in 04?
Up in the UP, yes.
Yeah. Okay, I couldn't remember just what year it was.
Yes, sir.
But
we did. Jim Moriarty. Yes.
Jim Moriarty was there.
And we had
a lot of them were in bad shape.
A few other recon guys were from that were just friends that were part of that mission. I mean, not part of the mission, but part of SOG. And then Jim had a couple other people that, John Plaster was there. Because John flew Covey Rider at that time. Yeah. And of course, John wrote about it in his books.
I never flew with Plaster as a prairie fireman. He didn't start until after Tailwind.
Right.
After I came home, then he started as a prairie fire rider. But he was an experienced 1-0 up there.
Oh, yeah. He had three tours of duty.
Yeah.
And the first two were on the ground, running recon. He's amazing. Yeah. Great books.
Yeah.
Factual. Well, sir, anything else? If not, we're going to put the final wrap on this, Gary.
Okay.
Well, in that case, we thank Gary for coming out and sharing his stories with us tonight. And as always, we thank Jocko Willink Productions for making SOG Podcasts possible. We thank you. As always, we still thank our service members that keep our country safe, the first responders, Border Patrol, and people that try to keep our country safe. And we always thank patriots and Air Force members like Gary Green thanking him for serving our country, and we thank the men and women who are serving today. And as usual, we try to close to remind people that today, we in 2024, we still have 1,574 Americans that are still listed as missing in action in Southeast Asia from the Vietnam War, which includes 58 Green Berets from the Secret War, an additional 40 Green Berets from different operations during the long Vietnam War. And we've documented at least 83 aviators, Marine Corps, Air Force, Army, who died and enlisted as missing in action in support of SOG missions. We salute them, and we thank again Jocko Willink Productions. God bless America.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. We ask that you kindly not be that guy, and instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone from their top brands in any condition on any unlimited plan for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 with Galaxy AI.
With new line on my plan, additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.